Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about birth control as healthcare. The U.S. Supreme Court last month ruled in the Hobby Lobby case that closely held companies with religious objections do not have to provide the full range of contraceptives as mandated by the Affordable Care Act. The nation's chief coalition of experts on birth control and maternal health, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, has publicly disagreed with that ruling. They noted, among other things, that contraception is essential health care for women, especially in the U.S., where more than half of, or about half of, pregnancies are unplanned. Joining us now by phone from Michigan is a member of the American College of OBGYNs and clinical director of obstetrics and gynecology at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Lisa Keeter. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Tell me about how birth control is essential health care for women.
Well, contraceptive methods and family planning in general are very essential for women's health. We know that women who are able to plan their pregnancies have lower rates of morbidity and mortality associated with their pregnancies, but beyond that, their infants also have lower mortality rates. That means that we see fewer women die from pregnancy and fewer infants die after delivery among women who are able to plan their pregnancies. And in order to do that, women need to have access and availability of very safe and effective contraceptive means.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Lisa Keeter of the American College of OBGYNs. She's also clinical director of obstetrics and gynecology at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. Dr. Keeter, Hobby Lobby didn't oppose all types of birth control. Why is the variety necessary? I think that the ones they opposed, it only affected maybe four different methods of birth control.
So the methods of birth control that were particularly under discussion in the Hobby Lobby decision were some of our more effective methods of contraception. So what was at contention were the two intrauterine devices that are currently on the market in the United States, and then the other topic had to do with emergency contraceptive methods or morning after types of contraception.
And why is it necessary to have all those varieties?
Well, women have different needs in terms of their contraceptive options. One of the things that we've learned recently in terms of contraceptive research is that the methods which are considered long-acting and reversible methods of contraception, referred to in my profession as LARC methods, including the intrauterine devices, are methods which have higher continuation and satisfaction rates among users. And therefore, those are very important methods in terms of preventing unintended pregnancies.
Dr. Keeter, we are going to call you back. We have a bad connection. In the meantime, listeners, we're talking about birth control as essential health care for women. In the Hobby Lobby case, the College of Obstetrics and Gynecology has opposed the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Hobby Lobby case, saying that birth control is an essential health care issue for women. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Lisa Keeter, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check us out on Facebook as well, and you can follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. If you have a question or comment about this issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Hobby Lobby did not object to all forms of birth control. As we just mentioned, Dr. Lisa Keeter is with us, going to be with us in just a second, and is going to talk about more about Dr. Keeter. Are you back?
I am back.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Hobby Lobby objected in particular to the mandate to cover IUDs, as you mentioned, intrauterine devices, and morning after pills like Plan B, because they said those methods also caused abortions. Can you tell us how those methods work and how they cause abortions?
Certainly, because I think that's a very important topic and piece of information, which is largely misunderstood. And I think it's important to understand how these methods of contraception work. Abortion is actually defined medically as the the interruption of an implanted pregnancy, which means that the process of conception of a pregnancy occurs when the sperm and the egg join, which generally occurs within the fallopian tube. The blastocyst, or fertilized egg, then implants within the uterus. Medically, we consider abortion to occur when that pregnancy, which has already been implanted, is interrupted somehow. In fact, the intrauterine devices, as well as the morning after contraceptives, are felt to interfere with pregnancy by actually preventing the process of conception. And therefore, those methods of contraception are truly not considered to result in abortion.
Because they prevent it from attaching in the first place.
Correct. Or prevent the egg from being released from the ovary. So, for instance, in the case of the morning after contraceptives, Plan B, or the second, which is available, which is trademarked under the name Ella, and is chemically something called ulipristal acetate. Those medications, which are considered morning after birth control, actually are felt to prevent the egg from being released or delay the release of the egg from the ovary, and therefore to prevent conception from occurring. In the case of the intrauterine devices, there are two types of intrauterine devices currently available in the United States. One, which is a hormonal-containing IUD, actually thickens the mucus that's in the cervix and prevents the sperm from reaching the egg. The second kind of IUD, which is a copper-containing IUD, the copper itself has an effect on the sperm and is felt to prevent conception by inhibiting or preventing the sperm from fertilizing the egg.
So why are they said to cause abortions? What do you know about the thought behind that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is in some ways a matter of semantics and perhaps belief, which goes beyond medical fact. So in medicine, we define abortion as interrupting an implanted pregnancy, meaning one that's already attached to the uterus. I think in the case of the folks who were involved in the Hobby Lobby suit, their concern was with the process of the pregnancy being conceived, and also perhaps really of having a misunderstanding about the scientific facts involved in what we believe are the mechanisms of action of these contraceptive agents.
Once again, my guest is Dr. Lisa Keeter of the American College of OBGYNs. She's also clinical director of obstetrics and gynecology at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you. Good morning. And thank you. I have been hoping for years to hear from the ACOG on WOSU News Program. Thank you. My question is it not the case that there was a major study in St. Louis some years ago, when poor women who were allowed whichever form of contraception, regardless of cost, fit them, their needs, in conjunction with their doctor's medical advice, the reduction in unwanted, unplanned pregnancies, and therefore so-called quote-unquote elective abortions, was reduced dramatically. In other words, if you're anti-abortion, you should be pro-contraception.
Dr. Keeter, are you aware of that study?
Yes. In fact, that's a really landmark study in the area of contraception, because in that study, the researchers were able to offer all forms, currently available forms of contraception, to women regardless of cost. And so they could provide free methods of contraception to women, and women could choose whichever contraceptive method that they wanted. And when they found that they were able to offer all methods and they would be available to women regardless of cost, that a large percentage of women chose, again, what we refer to as long-acting reversible contraceptives, including the intrauterine devices and the contraceptive implant. And so about 65-70% of women in that study chose those methods of contraception. And when they looked over the subsequent 2 years, at those women's use of contraceptive, they found that those women were more likely to continue their method of contraception and to be satisfied with their method of contraception when they chose a long-acting method of contraception. And we know that those are among the very most effective methods of contraception available. And so encouraging the use of these methods by removing the price barrier to women really was shown to be very, very effective in terms of reducing unplanned pregnancies.
And that goes back to your comment you made earlier about the higher continuation and satisfaction rates among the people
Correct.
Who use them.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us talk about cost. Are intrauterine devices and are they a lot more expensive?
They do have a high upfront cost. So between the cost of the device itself and the insertion fees, because it is something that a healthcare practitioner needs to place into the uterus,
mm-hmm.
the IUD, if someone paid for it completely out of pocket, would run close to $1,000 for the upfront cost. Now, if a woman uses one of those devices for the full 5 or 10 years, depending upon which type she chooses, the actual month-to-month cost turns out to be not that great. But the upfront cost that someone might need to pay for the device out of pocket could be prohibitive in terms of someone selecting that method if they did not have contraceptive coverage in their insurance.
Okay, Charlotte, thanks a lot for that call. And going back to the morning after pills like Plan B, tell us about that method and how that works.
Sure. Yeah. So Plan B is one of two currently available, what we refer to as postcoital methods of contraception, or those that are used after intercourse. So these are methods that we don't recommend on a routine basis as the woman's sole contraceptive. But they're useful in those cases when a woman might have had an accident with a condom or have not used a method of contraception, or, for instance, in cases of sexual assault. And these prevent pregnancy by about 50 to 75%, depending upon the timing of use after that act of unprotected intercourse. So they work, we feel, by preventing the release of the egg from the ovary or delaying ovulation and therefore making it less likely for a woman to get pregnant during that that particular menstrual cycle.
And you said you don't recommend it as a regular form of birth control. How often is it used? Do you know?
Well, really represents a fairly infrequent use in terms of women relying on it for contraception. I don't have an incidence mm-hmm. rate off the top of my head that I could tell you in terms of frequency of dosing in the United States.
Okay. Well, Dr. Lisa Keeter, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lisa Keeter is a member of the American College of OBGYNs and Clinical Director of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. Wellness Wednesday coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most of us associate coughing with bronchitis or a cold, at any rate, our lungs. Then there are those for whom the cough never ends. In fact, 20 million Americans suffer from so-called enigmatic chronic coughs that go untreated for years or are misdiagnosed as asthma. A new book addresses this condition. It's called The Chronic Cough Enigma, The Path to a Cure. Joining us now is the author, laryngologist, and the founder of the Voice Institute of New York, Dr. Jamie Kaufman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ian. Thank you very much.
So what is it that makes us cough in the first place? Is our body trying to dislodge something?
Well, no, that's not what's happening necessarily. It can be. My primary focus of my work, I started out as an ear, nose, and throat doctor and focused on problems of the voice and the throat. And what I learned is that the gastroenterologists who are supposed to know about reflux don't. in the 70s, they said reflux is heartburn, and heartburn is reflux, it's esophageal, and we own it. But in reality, reflux affects the airways more commonly. So it's asthma that isn't asthma, laryngitis that isn't laryngitis, sinusitis that isn't sinusitis, allergies that aren't allergy. So reflux can be a backflow of stomach contents into the throat, often at night while you sleep, and then deal with the symptoms all day long every day. So acid reflux and silent reflux in particular are, in my opinion, the most common misdiagnoses in America.
Asthma is a common ailment in the United States. Something like 40 million people have asthma. So what makes it such a common misdiagnosis in this case?
Well, I've been taking care of patients and doing special reflux testing, looking at airway reflux, meaning reflux all the way up into the throat and sinuses and lungs, since 1987. During that time, we've kept score of patients who come to us with reflux. With asthma. And it turns out that 4 out of 5 of them actually have reflux. So for the listener, here is the single most important question, the single most important pearl, the single most important distinction. Asthma is difficulty during exhalation, prolonged exhalation, getting the air out of your lungs. That's what you experience with asthma. However, if you have trouble getting the air in, inspiration, inhalation, then it's asthma. I'm all confused now. Then it's reflux. And the reason why it's reflux is in the throat, there are switches which close down the throat, I guess presumably to protect the lungs. So getting trouble air getting in, is usually silent reflux, and trouble getting air out is asthma. So for those of you who are listening, ask yourself that question, or someone you love has asthma. And if you have trouble getting air in, then you need to begin looking at this question of reflux and silent reflux in particular.
Are physicians who treat asthma aware of this? Are they starting to look at this as well?
They're not aware of it. We have more lung doctors. We have almost 400% more lung doctors in the United States per capita than a country like Canada. And they're all treating these people with asthma who don't have asthma. Interesting, had a patient recently, I said, no, this is all reflux. She said, I told my doctor it was reflux and it wasn't asthma. So we did the in-or-out thing. She said, yep, it's always been trouble breathing air in. And she went and told the doctor, and the doctor said, isn't that interesting? I never heard about that. So I sort of view the in-and-out thing is something everyone in the nation should know, that if you have trouble getting air in, it's not asthma. But I think this is partly goes back to this whole question of reflux being defined as heartburn, and heartburn is reflux. And the gastroenterologists don't even know that there is airway reflux. And airway reflux affects, we now think, 18% of the population. So it's the cough people, it's the asthma people who don't have asthma, and it's all these other things. And so if you're out there and you're not getting the outcome you want and you've had symptoms on and off for years, think about reflux.
Why would something that's giving you heartburn affect how you breathe in?
Well, the reality is that people with silent reflux don't have heartburn, and so it's completely overlooked.
So what is the distinction again?
The answer is in the throat, there are acid receptors. They're just like a set of switches. The work was done in my laboratory in 2002. We examined these receptors. And guess what? When the acid is pH 2.5 or less, these actually literally close down the throat. If you have this, that's called laryngospasm. And if you wake up in the middle of the night coughing, gasping for air like a fish out of water, it's not asthma, it's reflux. And the reason I think why this has happened this way, how could it go so long with physicians being so unaware, was that we kept going back to the gastroenterologist and asking him or her, is this reflux? And, of course, they're using tests for esophageal reflux. And so the answer is the gastroenterologist is unequipped to take care of, even diagnose, airway reflux. And as I said, it's almost 1 out of 5 people in the United States.
So here you are, an ENT, a laryngologist, doing the job.
Well, what's happened here is it's become quite clear that the healthcare system is out of control anyway. The specialist model of American medicine is not particularly working. If you know exactly what's wrong with you, even if you go to the orthopedist for a bad knee or the dentist for a bad tooth, you may or may not get the right treatment. Doctors used to make house calls, and now they make business plans. And so the problem comes is, what happens when you have a difficult diagnosis? What if you have chronic throat clearing or post-nasal drip? What if you have a cough that won't go away and the lung doctor says it's okay? What if you have asthma and the medicine doesn't really work, maybe the inhaler a little bit? Who do you go to? Do you go to an allergist, an ENT? And so what's happened is the entire breathing passages and digestive system has been so fragmented into little pieces that no one can see the forest for the trees. So the idea that I have is that the aerodigestive tract, this is one system. It ought to be treated by one doctor who understands how the parts are connected, and they are. And that's a new paradigm.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Jamie Kaufman, the author of a book about the topic we have today. The name of the book is called The Chronic Cough Enigma, The Path to a Cure. Jamie Kaufman is also the founder and director of the Voice Institute of New York. If you have a question or comment, want to run your chronic cough by Dr. Kaufman, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Dr. Kaufman will not diagnose over the air, of course, but may have some insights for you. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What are the differences between coughs caused by asthma and those by reflux? Does that go back to the, if it's, you're coughing on the intake?
It does.
Okay.
I think no, it's not coffee intake. Let me first describe so people know. People who have real asthma usually have allergies that are fairly obvious. These are the people who have trouble with, you know, cats and dogs and dust and so on. People who have reflux have different symptoms: post-nasal drip, chronic throat clearing, too much throat mucus, a sensation of a lump in the throat, pills that get stuck, hoarseness, particularly morning hoarseness, coughing, particularly after meals, getting up, lying down in the bed at night, bending over, and a variety of symptoms. For example, sinusitis. We see many patients here that have had sinus surgery, and they come back with the same symptoms, only to have the diagnosis be reflux and treat reflux. So that the constellation of symptoms is very typical. And someone's nodding out there going, I have all of those symptoms. It's interesting because the thing that's happened is in the last 25 years, the amount of reflux has skyrocketed. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that as this, you know, recession and everything else that's happened, people are working longer hours. Maybe after work they go to the gym and exercise. So they're getting home later and they're eating later. And they come home hungry and tired, so they usually eat, lie on the sofa, and then they'll get up and have maybe some ice cream or cookies and then go back to the sofa and then reflux all night. And that's the single greatest, it's very interesting how this has sort of been overlooked, the single greatest factor and risk factor for the silent reflux or the nighttime reflux, which, by the way, is associated with sleep apnea and snoring as well.
Russell, is it in Canal Winchester?
How are you doing today? My wife and my daughter both have acid reflux. We've found that there's two really natural cures that work. One is aloe juice, 4 ounces every evening, and it seems to heal the interior, and it's got her off of Prevacid. And every once in a while, we do the apple cider vinegar, which is unpasteurized.
I'm not even going to talk about that. Well, it may help some people. If you look in the medical literature, it damages the esophagus. It's not. There are some people for whom it probably increases gastric emptying, which will help their reflux. Okay, it is actually a huge red flag no for 90% of refluxers, and the reason is because there are digestive enzymes that are very nasty. In fact, the same ones that cause cancer, living on the throat and living in the esophagus, and acid is what stimulates pepsin, this enzyme. So acid cider vinegar, from my perspective, is a no with a capital N, a capital no and an exclamation point, whether it helps your family or not. Mm-hmm. Aloe vera is wonderful. Aloe vera has been around for centuries. Manuka honey is another natural remedy. Manuka honey and aloe vera must be the good stuff, though. Today, the aloe vera juices that come in a bottle that are prepackaged have been acidified because I have a book called Dropping Acid. By law, acid has to go in everything in a bottle except water. So as long as it's good aloe vera, it's a great home remedy.
Okay. Thank you, Russell, for that call. Stephen and Galena, you're on the air. Hi, Stephen. Or Steph, I should say. I'm sorry. Hello, Steph.
This is Deb.
Okay, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I wondered if we can rely on our primary care physician to help us be directed to different specialists if we're having trouble, or are they just more doing the basics these days? I'm kind of wondering where we can go for someone that does have a big picture.
The answer is I'm the biggest cynic in the country. Okay, first of all, there's a recent study that showed long-term use of the purple pill, you know the one, proton pump inhibitors, in a large Danish national study of 10,000 people. The conclusion was long-term use of proton pump inhibitors associated with an increased risk of esophageal cancer. Esophageal cancer is the fastest-growing cancer in the United States. It's up 850% since the 70s, and reflux, we're going to have this discussion, is about diet and lifestyle. And so there's so much that happened to American food since I was young and my mother cooked dinner every night at 6 o'clock. But these issues are the big issues that need to be addressed.
Gail in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I have a friend that every time she eats something spicy, like if we go to a Chinese restaurant and get hot and sour soup or any kind of spicy food, she gets these coughing fits. So I'm wondering if it's certain kind of foods that trigger these coughing fits.
Well, you've brought up a wonderful question. One of the hardest things about treating patients with reflux, particularly airway reflux and cough, one of the things we've learned is that everyone has different trigger foods. And that's tough. It means there's some trial and error and work to be done. Anything that burns your throat is a trigger food. Anything that causes you to feel like reflux has started almost before it's down in your stomach is a trigger food. But they can be even more subtle. And they vary. My trigger foods were white wine, cucumbers, green peppers, onions, had no problems with tomatoes or garlic. Chocolate was an absolute no-no. And those were my main ones, and lamb. Lamb was a huge reflux trigger for me, even a little taste. So you'll find that your friend's probably got some trigger foods that need to be avoided.
Okay. Gail, thanks a lot for that call. Is it just a matter of acid or no acid?
No, it isn't. It's unfortunately complicated. We know that the American diet has become acidified because in 1973, the FDA said, we got to stop this infections from bottles. And so by law, they said that things that are not already acidic have to be acidified. So when you read ingredients and it says all natural and it's whatever, coconut water and vitamin C, the vitamin C is not added there to give you vitamins. It's ascorbic acid, and it's done, same thing with citric acid, to acidify the beverage. The problem is that these companies have taken it to the extreme. So virtually everything in a bottle or a can is in the same acidity as stomach acid. And so if you have this enzyme, this nasty enzyme in your tissue, this is how you activate it. And so if you look at a lot of trends, the reflux trend, we're up 400% since the 70s. The cancer trend, up 850%. If you look at bone density problems in women, it's up. All of this really correlates magnificently with soft drink consumption in the United States since 1960s. And so that's why dropping acid is called dropping acid. It's nothing about drugs. It's about the idea that we need to reduce the acid intake of the foods we consume, particularly those who have reflux. Now, your question was a big one because you asked me what else. Nighttime reflux is a factor even if you eat healthy, and high-fat foods. So certain foods, if you have a burger with cheese and fries and a Coke and a chocolate pie for dessert, you've had a special high-fat, high-trigger-for-reflux meal. Now, people with 20-year-olds used to get away with it all the time, but now we're seeing reflux in the 20- to 30-year-olds, 37% of them. So this is across the population, these issues.
Why do you think we're now seeing it in that age group so much? Because they've grown up drinking pop and that kind of thing?
Yeah, baby food has acid in it now. Formula doesn't, but, for example, a famous brand, organic banana, it says, you know, banana and vitamin C. And the normal banana is very not acidic at pH almost 6. And yet if you measure this product, it's 3-point-something, which is the same as stomach acid. So even baby food has acid. And furthermore, there's more and more processed foods. I think the revolution that's going to occur here in this country is it's not going to happen until there's a critical mass. But a critical mass of people are going to stop wanting to eat stuff that has unpronounceable chemicals in it and have additives that aren't poorly defined. And we're going to have to insist that the FDA push for better labeling because, for example, people are on gluten-free diets. There's gluten in your Synthroid. There's gluten in products that have no labeling and don't have to be labeled. They're not required to label what's in the inactive ingredients. So I think there's a sort of a grassroots movement building towards the question of what are you actually eating? What are you actually consuming? And these questions are worthy.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Dr. Jamie Kaufman.
Thank you.
Dr. Jamie Kaufman, a laryngologist, founder of the Voice Institute of New York, also author of a new book. It's called The Chronic Cough Enigma, The Path to a Cure. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We often associate science with innovation, invention, and discovery, creating new products and machines that prolong and improve our lives. But some of the most promising innovations are based on the technology that surrounds us every day. That is, if you're lucky enough to be in nature. Joining us now to talk about Mother Nature as a role model for medical innovation is the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center's Residency Director and the Department of Emergency Medicine, Dr. Diane Gorgas. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to see you, Ann.
So the idea of medicine mimicking nature is so-called biomimicry. What are some examples of what we're talking about here?
This is something that we're just beginning to embrace as clinicians and innovators. But if you look at nature, there's kind of a multidisciplinary view of problem solving, because frankly, nature has been trying to problem solve some of our medical mysteries for way longer than we've been around as Homo sapiens. So a great example is looking at natural remedies. If we can take a primate, for example, who's having GI distress and reach for the same naturally occurring plants and organics that are found in their environment that would help them solve their own stomach problems, maybe that would help us model what we can do in humans to feel better.
You know, when you go out walking dogs, sometimes they like to eat grass. And some people say, no, don't stop them from eating the grass. It's going to make them throw up. There's a reason why they're eating the grass.
That's exactly right. There's a reason why they're eating the grass. Now, sometimes it can just be because it tastes good and they don't think about...
That's my dog. She never throws it up.
Never think about downstream possibilities. But mm-hmm. a lot of times, these are selection of the fittest type of behaviors that we're seeing. So it's not by accident that they're doing this. There's a genetic, there's a behavioral, there's a health purpose behind all of their actions.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest right now, Dr. Diane Gorgas from the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. We're talking about the idea of medicine mimicking nature called biomimicry. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what are some other suggestions, ideas along this line? Shark skin for infections?
Yeah. So shark skin is actually not a smooth surface.
It's kind of sandpapery, isn't it?
It's very sandpapery. It's made up of small, almost microscopic scales that inhibit the growth of bacteria on the shark skin, which it, if you think about environments where sharks swim and could become infected, this is actually a natural mechanical as opposed to a pharmaceutical method of bacterial downtrodding or really bacterial resistance.
Uh-huh.
And the problem that we face in medicine is that we tend to treat bacterials with antibacterial medication. Bacteria are very smart at finding ways around antibacterial medication, which leads to the entire problems of resistance. If we can instead look at a mechanical way to decrease bacterial overgrowth, then we may not run into problems with resistance downstream.
Like in things like our clothes, our furniture, that sort of thing?
In things particularly that would tend to penetrate the skin.
Okay.
And create an opening for bacteria to not only colonize, but become deep space infections and much more significant infections. So one of the great examples is looking at orthopedic surgery, where you have to use external fixators to fix some bone fractures.
Okay.
These are actually metal rods that protrude through the skin. Another great example is all of those patients that have mechanical devices where a portion of the device is implanted, but
okay,
a portion is external. You think about insulin pumps. You think about the new heart pumps. All of those things have an external and an internal component, and it's at that interface that we're very concerned about bacterial growth.
It makes sense that humans evolved along as part of nature, and nature would offer up some solutions, right? But we're kind of vulnerable.
We are definitely vulnerable.
Why aren't we more like sharks?
I know a number of humans that are very much like sharks, but that notwithstanding, if you think about our relatively short tenure on this planet as Homo sapiens, bacteria have been around millions of years, much, much longer than we have. Viruses have been around millions of years. Sharks have been around hundreds and thousands of years, much longer than we have. So those organisms have a lot longer time to adapt, a lot longer time to genetically develop defenses and mechanisms that naturally work with the environment.
And to what extent is our use of antibiotics stopping us from developing those natural defenses?
Yeah, exactly. Antibiotics are really causing us to accelerate the natural selection process for the bacteria.
Okay. It's strengthening the bacteria.
It's strengthening the every generation of antibiotics strengthens the bacteria and causes genetic mutations that make the bacteria resistant to those antibiotics in a much quicker way, magnitudes quicker than the bacteria would develop them on their own.
Another example is what sunshine and light therapy can help with. You were recently in Ethiopia doing work with infants who have jaundice. Let's talk about that.
Right. So we were there in a bigger initiative as part of the One Health Summer Institute for Ohio State and supported by the Greif Packaging Charitable Trust to look at ways to decrease infant mortality in developing countries. Neonatal jaundice, where babies actually have increased bilirubin levels, is not uncommon, but there are some clear risk factors for it in East Africa that augment the problem compared to those in developed nations. First of all, they're dark-skinned babies to begin with, so the condition can go unrecognized by unskilled providers. There's a lot of home births that happen there, so there's not routine neonatal testing for bilirubin levels. And it's, in general, a much sicker infant and newborn population than it is in developed countries. So you see a lot more stressors on the neonates because of that. You see their bilirubin levels increasing. And what we found is that natural sunlight does decrease the levels of bilirubin.
So why aren't they automatically getting natural sunlight anyways?
A lot of this is unrecognized. When we're talking about natural sunlight, we're talking about intense natural sunlight for a prolonged period. It's actually the blue spectrum of the light that is key for decreasing bilirubin. And you, especially with some of these newborns that have very high levels of bilirubin, over 12 or 15, there's a damage that they can actually get permanent developmental delays from staining of the brain, a condition called kernicterus. And in order to decrease the bilirubin levels when they're that high, it takes 20, 22 hours of sunlight a day, something that's just not physiologic. But putting them underneath intense blue light will actually help metabolize that bilirubin.
Another problem, of course, in East Africa is the lack of neonatologists, these specialists. You had an interesting statistic. It was sadly interesting statistic that there are, well, about how many Ethiopians are practicing medicine in the United States versus how many are there.
Right. The diaspora in Ethiopia is staggering. There are more Ethiopian physicians practicing medicine in Cook County, where Chicago is, currently, than there are in the entire country of Ethiopia.
Of how, 86 million?
87 million, yeah. Possibly. They don't have a formal census there. It may be as high as 92 million people within the country.
And that amounts to three.
Three neonatologists within that entire nation, yeah.
Oh, so it's a problem in the United States, but it's a bigger problem in Ethiopia. And it's not just because of fewer docs, less money, and darker skin. Why is that? What do we know about that?
Some other contributing factors are we know that there's a lack of prenatal care, there's a higher percentage of preterm infants, there's a much higher percentage of low birth weight infants. All of those present physiologic stresses to the newborn and can increase the propensity for developing this hyperbilirubinemia or the jaundice of the newborn.
Let's talk about the circumstances that you worked in there. You said there was no running water that day, but there was electricity, and that was good.
That was great.
And this is the hospital.
This is an 8-story hospital in the most populous city in the country of Ethiopia. 3.7 million people within Addis Ababa, which is the capital. 40% of those people are homeless. And the 8-story, truly ivory tower, tertiary care referral center in that city frequently has no electricity. And when we had been there, had had no running water for 6 weeks.
So how do they operate?
Yeah, it's a great question. All of our concepts of infection control, patient isolation, privacy, all of those really fly out the window. It was not at all uncommon in the neonatal intensive care unit to see a newborn isolette that is clearly manufactured for single occupancy use to have 3 or 4 babies in it.
And these are things that keep them warm when
Right,
yeah,
but also things that help isolate the babies from getting infections from another baby.
While
that
they're in this vulnerable state, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So Even simple things like the use of hand sanitizer is very limited there because of customs difficulties and ordering supply chain difficulties and just the poverty that is so rampant within the nation there. And if you don't have water, you certainly have no method of washing your hands.
So what did they do?
So it was limited use of hand sanitizer. They had some gloves, and it was limited use of gloves as well. But being cognizant of that and realizing that it's a barrier and realizing that there's little that you can do about it, I think is the frustration that the healthcare providers feel there every single day.
Now, in the United States, we're coming up through these crazy strains of bacteria that are popping up in hospitals, which is where they would pop up. It makes sense because so much there's been so much of this use of antibiotics in hospitals. Is there a problem with that in a place like Ethiopia?
It is not as common to develop resistance just because the relatively decreased use of antibiotics. But antibiotics are relatively inexpensive medications. And much of the time, antibiotics are started based on a whim. We call it empiric therapy. So you take a number of constellations of medical symptoms and you think, well, this sounds like pneumonia. I can't get a chest x-ray. I don't have any blood cultures in this hospital. I can't get any labs, but I think in my gut that it sounds like pneumonia, so I'm going to presumptively treat with an antibiotic. That can actually worsen your incidence of antibiotic resistance just because you're guessing at what you're treating a number of times as opposed to pinpointing the diagnosis and choosing the appropriate antibiotic.
Hmm. Let's go back to that biomimicry. You talked about sunlight and how if we can reproduce that in a safe way for a baby, we can address a lot of these issues with jaundice in Ethiopia and other countries like it where it's prevalent. There was another example of leeches as blood thinners.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me how that would be reconstituted as a treatment in the United States.
So we know that there are a number of animals that actually have kind of a natural clot buster or a natural blood thinner in them. Leeches is a great example. Vampire bats is another one that actually their saliva has a very powerful protein in it that you can use to clot.
And this makes sense.
Yeah.
Because they want to get the blood.
Absolutely. So how can a leech or a tick stay embedded for days and not develop a clot that starves it of its nutritional supply? That's the question. And with leeches, there's a protein called hirudin that we've been able to isolate, and it has some unique aspects compared to heparin that we use on an everyday basis for blood thinning.
Which is a synthetic. Okay.
That's exactly right. But studying these naturally occurring proteins and trying to figure, well, what advantage do they have and how can we utilize them, maybe even in patients that we see some negative effects of some of the manufactured pharmaceuticals that we have. We know that heparin can cause kind of a cascade of symptoms in some patients. It's a described syndrome that their blood chemistries and their blood clotting profiles can really go out of whack when we use heparin. And those patients, really, it's contraindicated to give them heparin again. So can we develop some other analogs from the natural world that may be good alternatives?
Hmm. And then what about sandcastle worms? What are they and what can we learn from a sandcastle worm?
It's a brilliant little organism. I've just been doing some reading about it. And just despite its fanciful name, this is an aqueous worm, so it lives underwater. It is able to secrete a type of glue to actually make a concretion or a shell around itself. But it is that perfect, unique glue that is strong. It is active in an aqueous environment. So can you imagine taking Elmer's glue into a pool with you and being able to glue two pieces of metal or rock
in
or
water.
Bone underwater together?
Right. No.
That is as unused. Exactly. Everybody go home and try
Don't
it.
Ever
it doesn't
ask me
work.
Questions. I know the answer to that.
That's
okay.
Right. But this glue actually works very well, and it's very hard, very durable underwater. So if we can remanufacture that glue into a pharmaceutical, easily available, relatively inexpensive material that we can use in medicine, imagine what we can glue together in wet environments, including bone.
The idea is if it's happening in nature, then it's less likely necessarily to be harmful to us, that if we can recreate that if these worms can stand it, probably so can we, or there's some equation of it.
Good point. We're not sandcastle worms. We may have other side effects of this, but that's what needs to be studied. That's really what needs to be looked at. I am not an expert in underwater glues of the sandcastle variety or otherwise, but there are people that are specifically studying this, and I think that it has a lot of promising effects for medicine in the future.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Diane Gorgas, she's residency director at the Department of Emergency Medicine at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today. And thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, who puts together Wellness Wednesday, production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannon, and Emily Williams, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrella, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks again. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.